It's the clock.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Okay, so we deliberately started 5 minutes late because I noticed the clock in the hall was 5 minutes late. And if I'm not mistaken, people were eating sticky buns and drinking coffee, which is much better than sitting in here probably. But at least I'm not the last one before lunchtime. That's always good. So it's really nice to be invited. Thanks very much indeed. I was saying the last time I was in this room was having a glass of warm white wine between listening to Frank Skinner on the stage. And I was just saying I won't be repeating any of the jokes that he told us that night. I'm local, well, not born local, as you can probably tell from my accent, but it's really nice as well. I know that the majority of the audience is not from Hull, which is really good as well. I don't know what you make of Hull. It's my home city now. I've adopted it. I've been here for 18 years, and we're very proud of everything that's happening in Hull at the moment. When I first came here, there was a joke about Hull which said there were only two ways to get to Hull. One was by the M62 and the other was by mistake. And it's really unfair, and I've just repeated it, but I think Hull has just moved on so much in recent years, and I hope that while you're here you'll see a bit more of the city and what's going on at the moment in the city of culture. Okay, I've been asked to talk about from ideas to publication, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Advanced Nursing. Some of you may have heard of the Journal of Advanced Nursing, and I'm the editor as well of Nursing Open. They're both Wiley. This is a sort of that's the stable from which they come, and the Journal of Advanced Nursing is a kind of traditional journal where you write your paper, you send it off, you wait to hear, and it gets published. If you're lucky. And the Nursing Open is a slightly different model whereby you send your paper off, you wait to hear if it's going to get published, but in order to get it up there it has to be paid. It's an open access journal. So they're slightly different models, and I am going to talk about open access towards the end because it's something that mystifies a lot of people, but there's also a lot of charlatan journals out there ready to take your money but to do very little else for you, so you have to be very careful. And I'm sure any of you who've published anything or have given a public presentation or are anyway in the public eye in the academic world or your clinical world will be inundated daily with emails asking you to publish in pretty spurious journals or attend a conference. So I just want to warn you right at the beginning that you've got to be very careful about these things. So I'm going to talk about several things here. It's going to be the peaks of the mountains. I'm not going to go into much depth in anything because there isn't time. But I'm going to talk about the process of publishing, just so you understand a bit about that, because I think that always helps people to know what's happening when they submit a paper. I'll talk a little bit, very slightly, about very quickly about the actual process of writing, one or two hints and tips there. But then I want to get on to some of the sort of standards in academic publishing that you need to be aware of these days if you're publishing, especially if you're working in clinical trials, and then open access and dealing with reviewer comments, that kind of thing. So mop up a few different areas. My email will be on the last slide, so you're welcome to email me afterwards if you've got any questions, specifically about these journals, but about publishing in general. Don't hesitate. I don't think we'll have time for questions unless I do get finished quite quickly. Towards that end, I shall take my watch off and keep an eye on it. I'm just going to say that the theme of the meeting, as far as I understand, is endometriosis. And I was just Googling when I was standing over there when the last speaker was on the journal to see if we had actually published anything on endometriosis. And the last time we published a paper which had it in the title was 2014, so we don't publish a great deal on endometriosis. The last paper that had it as a search term was this year, but it was about chronic pain in general. So we don't have a great deal, and I just have to say that there are areas like this which are are always of interest. I'm not saying that you'll automatically get published, but I'd like to see more. And it's just one of the rules of publishing and the media, women's health is always of interest. You know, so we publish papers on women's health, they almost inevitably get picked up by the newspapers and social media, blogs and that kind of thing. So it's just one of these things we have to live with. Other areas of health don't seem to be quite as attractive, and some of them are a lot more serious, but it is one of these things that you can get women's health research published and into the public eye fairly easily. Okay, this is how most people, those of you who've tried to publish may recognise this. This is how most people see the publishing process. This is you down at the bottom. I know it's a stereotyped male scientist, but just imagine yourself. That's you at the bottom with your manuscript in your hot little hand. These days it's all done online, of course. It wouldn't be done this way. And you're trying to get your paper accepted. And all it seems like is there's a bunch of people along the road, including myself, my editors, my production team, and everyone else, ready to chop you down, you know, with death's head at the end, ready to kill you off. And that is actually, it is actually true to some extent, but we're not there to make things difficult for you. The job of the editors and the reviewers and the people on the production team is to take what you write and to try and make sure it's the best possible stuff that we can get into the journal, but also if it's going to go into the journal, to make sure that it's as good as it can be. So what you submit to a journal is almost never what gets published. There's always a bit of processing along the way, and you've really got to kind of understand and almost accept that. If you don't accept it, it can be difficult to get published. So don't worry too much about all the different people along the way. Different journals have got different acceptance rates. Our acceptance rate hovers around 20%, so that means that we reject about 80% of the papers that come into the journal. Simply on the basis of space, we can't publish anything, and we want to publish within a reasonable time, but again, we reject them as editors and reviewers on the basis of the quality of the articles or what fits and what's new. It doesn't mean to say that if you get rejected by any journal that you can't get published somewhere else. So, you know, don't give up. It just means that journal doesn't want it. So we publish around 20%. So you've got, all things being equal, you've got roughly a 1 in 5 chance of being published. All things, of course, are not equal, because people make a mess of the papers they submit. They don't follow the rules, and immediately we don't have time to help or process those. We can only look at the ones that really follow the rules or the guidance that we give you. So that's something I'm going to mention later as well. Don't copy that. If anybody wants a copy of these slides, please ask me for them, or go. You'll find me on SlideShare on LinkedIn. They're all up there, different versions of these slides. You can have them. I don't expect you to copy that down. But just to show you, the publication process is a process, and this is the same for any journal, medical, nursing, scientific, social sciences. It doesn't really matter. There's a process through which all the papers go, and unfortunately, there are more ways in pink to be rejected than there are to be accepted. There is only one way to be accepted, and that's to get through every step and possibly revise the paper and then get down to the green area, which is production and publication, which is where you want to get to. The initial stage, the second top one is the editor-in-chief, that's me. When papers come into the journal, they come direct to me. That's usually someone in my position, editor, editor-in-chief, and we scan them very, very quickly. Title, abstract, might have a look at the paper for some specific details and make our mind up if it's going to go forward or not. I've got, I do this at about 7 o'clock in the morning usually, and I've got, 2 or 3 minutes per paper. So you've got to make sure that when I look at the abstract and the title, and if I look for any specific features, things that I will mention later, they've got to be there. Otherwise, I'm afraid the chances are the paper might be rejected, especially from a journal like mine, which has got a high rejection rate. Then we check the similarity. Those of you who've done academic programs lately or are teachers will be familiar with Turnitin. We use a system called Authenticate, which is exactly the same platform but sold to the publishing industry. So we look for similarity in the papers, and if they're too similar, we question it, we try to get rid of it, and sometimes it throws up the fact that people have copied other people's work. If that's the case, then you're in trouble. And then the managing editor, I'm lucky I've got a full-time managing editor, but there's usually somebody else beyond that who reads the paper in full, looks at the use of English, and I'm not just referring here to people who are not from the UK, you know, looks at the use of English, looks at the application of the various standards, and if they're not met, I'm afraid that, again, the paper can be rejected at that stage. If you get through all those horrible people, you're into the process, the paper goes out for review, and then the editors are dealing with it after that, and you've got a good chance of being accepted if you get past those initial stages, believe me. So, just to show you, this is the figures from last year. We, in 2015, we published from 56 different countries, and we had over 1,000 submissions. That's slightly down on previous year's submissions, but you know, we do get a lot of submissions. And just again to emphasise, you're competing with the whole world in a journal like the Journal of Advanced Nursing. It's not like the Nursing Standard or a local practice journal or a specialist society journal. You're competing with the whole world, and you know, the big blue area on the left is the United States. That's where most publications come from. On the right, the green areas are Saudi, China, areas like that. These are the most rapidly accelerating areas. The UK is sort of a little blue blob next to America there. So, we're, you know, there's a lot of competition, not just nationally, but internationally, for space in journals, and it's just going up all the time. So, if you want to write and get published, you've got to understand, first of all, to write for editors, okay? When I first started writing, my first thought was, what will my mum think if she sees this in print, or will my friends be proud of me, what will my colleagues think? If you think like that, you're very likely not to get published. You've got to think, what do the editors want, first of all, or you won't reach the audience. And the editors want you to match the guidance to the journal, which I will speak about. Then think about the reviewers. We use a peer review process, a double-blind peer review in our journal, whereby the editor knows who the paper is, the reviewer doesn't know who the author is, and vice versa. Just be aware that some journals are now introducing open review. So just be sure, you know, if you're going into an open review journal like Biomed Central Journals, that the reviewer will know who you are and you will know who they are, and the reviews will be posted along with the accepted article if it's accepted. Some people don't like that system. We use double blind, but the point is that the reviewers are experts. So if you're submitting a paper on endometriosis, we would hope to find somebody who we thought actually knew about it, to make sure that the clinical details were up to date. If it was a quantitative study, we'd find a statistician. If it was a qualitative study, we'd find an expert in that area. So we try our best to subject the papers to expert review, which will help us to find papers which are not worthy of publication, which have mistakes in them, or they will tell you how you can revise it to make it better. And we have to come to a judgment of the decision that we take after we get the reviewer's comments back. So don't try and fool the reviewers. We hope to try and find people who know about the subject. It's not a scientific process. Sometimes reviewers get it wrong. Sometimes one reviewer says fantastic, another one says terrible. We've got to live with that, but at least we try and get some expert view on the paper. Then finally, again, if you get, it's all getting through different hoops or jumping through hoops. If you get past the editors and the reviewers like the paper and the editors accept their decision, then you will get published and your audience will get to read the paper. Once you're published, I'll pick this up at the end, the process isn't finished these days. The previous speaker was mentioning social media and using social media. We use that a great deal to promote papers, and I'll come back to that. I won't try and preempt it too much. So, that's the publishing process. I'll come back to things that are concerned with standards in a minute. But what I want to talk about next is actually going about writing. I think that, you know, that really is the difficult thing, isn't it? It's finding time to write, making good use of time when you write, and having a process whereby you can take your writing from your raw ideas and getting them into publication. And this is long before you submit the paper, okay? This is the sort of things that you need to think about before you submit the paper. Again, I won't have time to go into each of these in details. The four rules of writing is an hour's session on its own, but I just wanted to run through them quickly. Top of the list, read the guidelines for the journal. They're always available somewhere. One of the most common reasons, if not the most common reason, for people not having papers sent into the review process by me is that they don't follow the guidance. I got 5 papers this morning, and I only put 1 forward, but 2 of them just clearly didn't meet the guidance. Other ones were not aimed at the right journal. There's all sorts of reasons why they wouldn't be acceptable to go forward, but 2 of them clearly didn't follow the guidance. If you're writing, and I must say, I'll just go back a second. If you read the guidance for the journal, the guidance for the journal will tell you important things which will help you to write the paper, like sections and subsections. Next thing is to set yourself targets and count words. I think we all think in terms of, if we notice that the paper's going to be 5,000 words, we think about is 5,000 words. Because we're all ex-students, and what we did was we left our 10,000-word essays and dissertations right to the last minute, and we sat down on a Sunday night and wrote 10,000 words for submission on a Monday. You know, that's not the way to get papers published. The way to get papers published is really to take... You're not under any pressure to get it published with any particular time. It's to break it down into tasks. I do 500 words a day. You might do less, you might do more. But it's a good idea to set yourself targets when you're writing papers. It's one of the best things I learned as a writer, was to stop trying to do the whole thing at once. And there are different tricks that you can apply after you've written your words to make sure you pick it up at the same place later. And also, you know, count the words as you go through. You must seek some criticism from people if you're writing. I'll come back to that in a tick as well. And finally, something I won't expand on, but I tangentially mentioned it earlier, treat each rejection as the start of the next submission. There's all sorts of rumours fly about you can only submit a paper once, you can only submit it twice. We don't know where you've submitted it before. It doesn't matter to us. You can submit it to us, submit it somewhere else. You've taken the time to do research, you've written it, hopefully you've gone through the process of getting some criticism, and it's as good as you can get it. It'll get published somewhere. Keep going. So don't be cowed by rejection. And if you're working on several projects or papers, the paper that comes back for revision is the one at the top of the list. Get it done straight away. Don't put it back to the bottom of the pile again. It's always annoying to get rejected. You know, I remember hearing a colleague screaming down the corridor one morning at 9 o'clock when she opened a letter. I won't say exactly what she said, but it was my journal had just rejected her paper. You know, something or other, Journal of Advanced Nursing has just rejected my paper. You know, it really, really upset about it, and kicking the drawers, slamming drawers. And well, that's it then, she said. I said, well, no, you can put it somewhere else. I know where she wanted to put it, but I won't mention. Okay, now this is another, just before I move on, this is another thing that, a big lesson I learned on my way towards becoming, you know, a more successful author, certainly. This is not the way to write, okay? This is a real photo, well, obviously a real photograph, it's not posed. This is from a colleague of mine, and I asked her, we were writing a paper together, and she lived just along the road from me, and I said, how are you getting on with the paper, Pash? She's from Thailand. She said, sent me this, or she put this up on Facebook and said, how do you think I'm getting on? You know, so, you know, you can see, surrounded by every paper she's ever read, she's got her hand cream, biscuits, thing to tie her hair back, mobile phone, everything's there, you know. But the thing that shouldn't be there is all these different papers. I think what we do is we read lots of papers, we pile them up beside us, and we get determined to chisel them in or hammer them into the paper. I think you've got to learn to get rid of all that and just write, and then go to the papers and refer to what you want. Otherwise, you just write in a staccato fashion. There's nothing wrong with writing what you think and what you want. You've got to support it in some way, but you won't write just trying to get every other idea into it. So I think, you know, try it sometime. If you're the sort of person who sits with lots of PDFs open on your screen or lots of papers around you all marked up, yeah, by all means read them, stick them away, and just start writing. It was a revelation to me when I was, you know, I'm talking about 20 odd years ago. But again, we learn as students. This is what we do on a Sunday night for the essay that's in on a Monday. We sit surrounded by everything we've ever read and then try and get it in there. But it doesn't really work for scientific papers. Okay, I'm not here to advertise my journal, by the way, but obviously I can only use the examples from my journal. That's the landing page for the journal. What I want to show you there is that this is the same for any journal, the BMJ, the Lancet, Journal of Advanced Nursing, maybe not in quite in the same bracket, but you know, in terms of impact factor and such like. But we've got guidelines on the landing page. You have to look at these. That should be the first thing that you look at. I just warn you that the guidance is copious. There's over 100 pages of printed Arial size 11 font, single spaced, if you print our guidance. You don't have to read it all. Some of it's for clinical trials, some for qualitative, some for surveys, some for protocols. Find the bit that applies to your paper and just ignore the rest. But there are some certainly key things that you need to find out for every paper. But do check the guidance first. And I would strongly recommend that if you're thinking of submitting a paper, that you go to the, you find a journal and you write it for that journal. You may have to rewrite it for another one, but you write it for that journal. Otherwise, you waste a lot of time writing things that will be in the wrong format, wrong referencing, you know, and then you'll just have to do it again. So the journal guidelines tell you the length of the paper. That's very important. You've got to get that into your head at the beginning because that will dictate how much you're going to write. You may write more than that and cut it down. The layout, we still like large font, double-spaced, wide margins. It just looks terrible otherwise. My colleague Mark Hayter, who addressed you last year, has a saying. He says, make a manuscript look like it's been cared for. Make it look like it's an academic paper. There's nothing worse than changes of font, changes in spacing, changes in margins. It just puts an editor off the paper. And we're very superficial people. We don't have much time. Organisation, by which I mean the headings and subheadings. Some papers use findings, some use results, some use introduction, some use background. Use what they do. Otherwise, you haven't followed the guidance. And that's an easy shot for an editor or a managing editor to look at. Yes, you could change it, but it depends how good your paper is if you're going to be given the chance to change it. Follow everything that you can in the guidance. It's an easy thing to do. And the referencing system. If it's Vancouver, use that. If it's Harvard, use that. Don't swap them around. It's a dead giveaway to an editor that you haven't read the guidance if the referencing system isn't correct. Boring stuff, I know, but it's all very necessary to get your paper past that first hurdle. Seek criticism. Find yourself a critical friend. Okay, you must do this. Most of us write in teams these days, but even so, it's always good to get someone else to have a look at your paper. If you're writing by yourself, you know, it's essential to get someone to look over your paper, unless you're on a really tight deadline. But it's always a good idea to do it, because whenever anybody else looks at something, they'll always point out something that will improve the paper. The best question anybody can ask, whether they're an expert or not, is, I don't understand that point. What do you mean there? If they don't understand it, the editor won't understand it, the readership won't understand it. So it's always a good thing to do. So try and find, they don't find that sort of person. We all work with the departmental lunatic who thinks everything you do is wrong and shouts at you and is very critical. They're no help at all, you know, and we all have people like this. Avoid like the plague, you know, don't set yourself up for undue criticism. It doesn't help. But don't find the big huggy bear who always says, that's fantastic, and hands you back the manuscript just as you handed it to them, because it isn't fantastic. It can always be changed. Nothing's terrible. Everything can be changed slightly. So try and find the sort of person. I apologise for the sexist image of the man helping the woman up the mountain, but say, you know, somebody who's been there before and done it, especially somebody who's published before, is always helpful. And somebody who will give it back to you in good time. And if you're asked to do this for other people, do it for them, and it creates a good team, a good atmosphere in your department or amongst your colleagues. Right, that's all I want to say about the actual process of writing. I want to move on to some of the standards in publishing, which are becoming more important these days. You may or may not know about these standards, but believe me, they're growing every week. There seems to be another standard coming out. 10, 15 years ago, this didn't exist. And by standards, I mean different standards for different kinds of papers. And there's not a single classification of paper for which there isn't some standard out there. If you want to find them, have a look on the Equator webpage. I'm going to show you two web pages today, Equator and COPE. And if you did nothing else and thought, you know, nice man, but I didn't understand what he was saying, but went off and looked at these web pages, that would be my job would be done. One's about standards, one's about ethics. So have a look at the Equator webpage. Everything won't be relevant to you. I'm not going to go through everything here. I'm going to give you the headlines. So the main thing that we take, two main things we take from the Equator webpage. First of all, the consort guidelines. You may have heard of these. These are the guidelines you need to follow if you're publishing a randomized controlled trial. And there's a page, consort page, and you can get to it separately through Google. You don't have to go in through the equator. It is updated pretty regularly. This is as up to date, I think, as it can be at the moment. There are two important things. You see the top right on that list there, the consort checklist and the consort flow diagram. The checklist gives you things to check off if you're doing a clinical trial that we expect to see done in the paper. But it's also a good thing to look at if you're writing the paper, because it tells you what needs to be in the paper and it tells you how to structure it. It's also a great thing to look at if you're going into doing clinical trials, because actually it's a model lesson on everything you need to do. And one of the things that's on that list is registration of the trial. I'll come back to that in just a second. But I rejected two clinical trials this morning because they weren't registered. Then the flow diagram, and the flow diagram has to be in the paper. You've probably read papers and glanced and seen this sort of flow diagram. Everyone who could be in the trial has to be accounted for right down to the end. Everyone who died, everyone who dropped out, everyone who didn't go forward for treatment, but you know, everybody you thought could be in and everybody you finally got, which is usually not the same number, has to be accounted for. And then if you're into statistics, you can do intention to treat at different levels and see if the dropout had a differential effect on either of the groups. So this is an essential feature. And the good thing is that the consort webpage has a Word diagram, a Word document of the diagram. You can fill that in and paste it into the diagram. We'll publish it exactly like that. You don't have to spend ages doing three-dimensional boxes with arrows and things like that on Word, because it takes too long and usually looks worse than the actual diagram. Those of you who are doing clinical trials, those of you who have knocked something off here, I don't know what it is, those of you who are trials nurses will understand registration of trials. You have to. We conform at Wiley, generally, to the All Trials campaign, which says that every published clinical trial has to be registered in advance, and we now will not publish things that are not registered in advance. And you can register on, strangely there isn't a UK site for registration, unless somebody can tell me of one, but I can't find one. There's clinicaltrials.gov, which is an American site, but your hospital or your university has to be registered with that in order to for you to register. And there's an EU clinical trials register, which we may be able to use for the next couple of years, but we won't be in the EU for very much longer. So you've got to register your trial somewhere. In other words, the protocol, what you're going to do, trial registration number needs to be available so that it's in the public domain before you start the trial. Can't emphasise the importance of that enough, because if you do a clinical trial, you've wasted your time if you haven't registered it. But I'm sure that your trials units are aware of this wherever you are. Okay, so the next thing the next big thing is the PRISMA guidance, and the PRISMA guidance is the guidance we use for presenting systematic reviews and meta-analysis. Very important part of our work is to publish these. And again, there's a web page. There's all sorts of different PRISMA guidance for different kinds of reviews. But there's a checklist and a flow diagram. Again, we expect to see the checklist submitted, and the flow diagram looks mighty like the other one, and it does the same thing. These are all the papers that you found initially using your search terms and how you got rid of them down to from the 10 million that you found on Google Scholar down to the 3 that you actually read in the end. It's always a ratio, huge ratio difference between what you get at the end and what you get at the beginning and what you actually did with them. So again, if you've submitted a systematic review to the Journal of Advanced Nursing or any high quality journal these days, we expect to see that diagram. Right, so that's the sort of standards for publishing particular kinds of papers. Again, have a look at the Equator webpage if you haven't looked at it before. Another webpage which I would urge you to take a look at is the COPE webpage. I don't know whether you know about COPE or not. Committee on Publication Ethics, formed in 1987 by the editors then of The Lancet and the British Medical Journal. It's a UK initiative. However, it is now worldwide and adopted by most high-quality medical, health, nursing-related journals. Not all of them by any means, but most of them. And COPE provides training for editors, publishers, and how to detect unethical behaviour. It's the Committee on Publication Ethics. So we're looking out for things like plagiarism, copying other people's work, duplication, submitting your work to more than one journal at the same time and having it published, fabrication, making results up, and falsification, making optimistic use of your results, put it that way. All these things happen, they're all wrong. They also deal with authorship disputes, which I'll come to as well. So do have a look at the COPE webpage. It looks a bit like that. It's got a whole bunch of stuff on there that's useful for you, and I can't emphasise this enough. The most useful thing, I think, for people who are setting out on a writing career is to look at the codes of practice for authors. And if you're being asked to review papers, there's codes of practice for reviewers as well. They're all very obvious. The author's ones are, you know, thou shalt not do this, that, and the next thing. You know, make sure you don't copy, make sure you don't make it up and whatever, and taking steps to declare that and to declare conflicts of interest and to make sure the authorship's right. For the reviewers, it's not sharing the paper with anything, not divulging it, you know, whatever, and declaring again if you've got a conflict of interest. If you just had a paper into review and you know it's from your best friend, then you probably shouldn't review it, and if it's from your worst enemy, you probably shouldn't review it either. And we all have those. I once the ultimate conflict of interest is when you receive your own paper to review, and that happened to me once a long time ago. I don't know how that can happen, but it did. You can sign up for the COPE newsletter. It's fantastic. It comes out monthly, and it gives you a digest of all the things that we academics get up to that are wrong, you know, and our medical and other colleagues. Fantastic stuff. You won't believe some of the things that people do. I haven't got time to go into it here, but the unethical behaviour is usually more amusing. You're always left thinking, what on earth were they thinking when they did that? If you're into prurience and looking at the bad things people do, sign up for Retraction Watch, and you'll get several emails a day, you know, on papers that are pulled out of the public domain, or at least they're not pulled out, but they're retracted in the sense that they're no longer, you know, bona fide papers. And again, you'll just shake your head in wonderment at what people do. And one of the things is it seems to be a trait. The person who plagiarises once or fabricates one will do it again and again and again. They get into a pit of trying to just, you know, a pit out of which they can't dig themselves. They just dig themselves deeper because they're just going to keep covering their tracks. And you find that people's whole careers are sometimes ruined right at the end by going back through their papers. You won't do it. I know you won't, but just make sure you don't. But of course, you may be working with other people who might do it, and you've got to be equally careful. Don't trust anyone. I don't want to, you know, I'm saying create a nice atmosphere in your team, but at the same time, don't really trust them. I've had to speak to colleagues over similarity on more than one occasion. And the other thing that you'll find here, do check it, are the flowcharts, which are for my use as an editor. And these are flowcharts which tell me what to do if I suspect you've done something wrong. Suspected case of plagiarism, step one. If the author responds in this way, you know, another algorithm, step two, so on. Right down to if we have to hunt you to ground and you won't tell us what you've done, you won't own up to it, you won't correspond with us, telling your employer. And people lose their jobs over this kind of thing, so just don't do it. And don't think this is rare. I am never, very bad grammar here, but I am never not dealing with an ethics case, never. There's always something going on. Right. The International Committee of Medical Journal Editors is another body. You don't have to look at this, but it is interesting. They've got a really good section on conflicts of interest, and again, we don't have time to go into it in detail here. A lecture on ethics is a lecture on its own, but there are conflicts of interest you often wouldn't think of. So if you think you've got any conflict of interest with the publication of a paper, it's not wrong to have a conflict of interest at all. We all have conflicts of interest. You have to declare it. You know, I work as a visiting professor at lots of universities across the world. I've just been in China for a week. They're all aiming to get stuff into my journal. You know, when that paper's published, it has to be declared that I'm a visiting professor at that university. You know, it's not wrong for me to do that or to encourage them, but people have got to know that, or they may think I'm getting a backhander to get the papers in. Simple things like that that sometimes we don't think of. But the thing that we're really keen on from the ICMJE website is their guidance on authorship. And I'll just quickly get on to that. They state that anybody who writes for a paper should have made a substantial is a judgment, of course, contribution to the conception, design of a paper, or acquisition of data, or analysis and interpretation of data. And they should have drafted the article for and revised it critically. And the important thing is that everybody whose name is on a paper should have agreed to the final copy. Now, my journal and the BMJ and many journals divide this up into three ors, not ands, because it's quite difficult to meet all those things. You have to have had something to do with design, or you have to have had something to do with the data, or you have to have made a contribution to writing it, not just editing it or saying it's fine, but a substantial contribution. So teams have got to judge this. Nothing we can do afterwards if something goes wrong. We're trying to help you to get it right at the beginning. And of course, all sorts of things happen. Power conflicts. You know, the local professor or consultant may have walked through the ward where your clinical trial was going on, and it's always a man, he wants to get his name on the paper. Well, if he's not done anything to do with the paper, if he's not done one of these things, he should not be on the paper. Simple as that. And I know it's difficult, but them's the rules. If you've done something like that, you should be on the paper, and it's tragic when people get missed off. Because if you get missed off a paper, you can never be added to the authorship again once it's published with a DOI. Your name can appear in Medline or CINAHL or Google Scholar or things like that, but it will never be on the paper when people print it off. So it's a very serious issue. It breaks my heart when people have genuinely done the work and can prove it but aren't on the paper. There's nothing we can do. All we can do is get an addendum, corrigendum published, but it doesn't really help on your CV. And we use Authenticate. I've mentioned this already, so I've preempted myself there. But we run every single paper, goes through Authenticate at the beginning, and if we're in any doubt after it comes back for revision, we'll run it through again. Costs a fortune to do this, but we do it because we've got a real duty to try and make sure that people are not behaving unethically. And if you do something wrong, then your paper doesn't come off the website. It appears in its entirety with a watermark through it saying retraction and a statement next to it. And, I usually have a bigger version of this, but it says, in this one it says, the retraction's been agreed due to overlap with other previously published material written by third parties. Just a nice way of saying that this geezer stole all the material from somebody else and used it as his own, you know. This person's a professor of nursing somewhere in Australia, as it happens, but we dealt with a case of duplication recently, a few years ago, and that person lost their job, so it can be very serious. Right, I mentioned before that you've got a lot of international competition. Very quickly, try and make your papers internationally relevant. You know, don't head your papers with a title saying a small local study in Wolverhampton. You know, just don't shoot yourself in the foot. Just say what the study is. If it's a study of, you know, a clinical trial of one treatment versus another for endometriosis, state that. Let the person read the paper and find out where it comes from and the size of it. A title like that will just shoot you in the foot straight away. Also try to think how relevant it will be to people in other countries if you're publishing it. Read the international literature, cite it. So try to think about things like that. In the abstract, you know, try and refer to the global aims. I don't mean, when I say global, as wide as you can make it. Include the name of the country that the work was undertaken in somewhere in the abstract, of course. You've got to own that up. And try to emphasise the international relevance in the conclusions to your paper. Also try to avoid colloquial language like NHS trusts and things like that. If you have to say that, explain that that's the organisational unit in the United Kingdom. Sorry, in England. Not in Scotland, we still have health boards up there. But that doesn't apply in any other country. So if you're using language like that, you've got to make sure you state what it is and why people might be interested. So don't expect to get something written and published, you know, very quickly. James Michener was asked, are you one of the world's greatest writers? He says, no, I'm one of the world's greatest rewriters. You know, you need to go through over things time and again. Another hint to do with writing. So, and you've also, this is something I find people find very difficult. And I was speaking to someone about this yesterday, is letting go. You have to let go at some point. It will never be perfect. It'll be as good as you can get it. And just send it off and take the outcome, which may be good or maybe bad, on the chin, but you've got to learn to let go. If you don't let go, then you won't have a success at getting your work out there and published. It's difficult to take criticism, but believe me, after 25 years in the industry, you get used to it. If you get papers back from reviewers, you have to deal with the comments. Don't ignore them. That's the main thing. So apply the golden rules. Answer completely. Answer everything you're asked to address. Answer politely, it never helps to be impolite. And answer with evidence. So answering completely. Deal with every point, even if you don't agree with it. So if there's a point that you think you cannot change, the reviewers made a mistake, the editors misunderstood, you've got to say that. You know, you can't ignore it. If you leave a blank, then that's a sure sign that you're not dealing with the point. Make a list of points and say how you've dealt with them specifically. Answer politely. Don't start with, "We completely disagree with the comments of the reviewer," or "Who on earth are your reviewers?" We've seen it all before. We try to emphasise to our reviewers to be polite, so we expect authors to be polite as well. And if there's evidence that you need to disagree with, provide the facts, give the references, give the numbers, give the websites or whatever. Don't just make a bold statement that was wrong. You need to explain why it's wrong. Okay, whoops. That's sort of everything about the publication process. I want to move on to a few, by no means peripheral things, but slightly different from what I've been saying so far. We make massive use of social media in publishing industry these days. In fact, we've become rather obsessed with it. I mean, at the Journal of Advanced Nursing, we have a YouTube site, a podcast site, a blog, a Twitter site, you know, and you can follow us on Twitter. Very easy to find us, at JADNursing. We've got about 18,500 followers, which is pretty good for a nursing journal. But we make widespread use of these things. So if you publish these days, I think you should be prepared to also make use of social media. Get your retaliation in first. Send a link of your paper out to people. Don't be shy about it. You know, get it out there. Yeah, you'll get criticism. That's fine. That's life. That's the academic life. Try and push what you're doing out on social media. Facebook, Twitter, that kind of thing. We also try to encourage people to make podcasts or YouTubes. Very few people do, but it's remarkably easy to do that. So if you're not a Twitterer, then it's happening, okay? It's out there. It's not as popular with younger people these days as it used to be. There's young people in this room. I'm not one of them anymore. I think my children think I'm right old fuddy-duddy for still using... You're not using Twitter, are you, Dad? But in the academic world, it's still very big, and it's really taken a hold, and in the clinical world as well. I don't really think Snapchat, Instagram, and all these things are going to replace it. I may be wrong, but they're for a different reason altogether. So try and get yourself a Twitter site and learn. You know, the power of a retweet is unbelievable. You know, it amplifies your message very quickly, something that Facebook doesn't do. Twitter can be read by anyone. So, for example, here's one tweet to 2,000 followers goes out to 7,000 people. Three different people pick it up, retweet it. It gets to 20,000 people in three steps. Now, all of those 20,000 people won't read the tweet. All of those 20,000 people won't read the link, but imagine if 10% of them did. That's a huge number of people that you're reaching that you would not have reached otherwise. And I've seen this happen. I mean, I've seen things being amplified very quickly on Twitter, especially controversial things, but that's another matter. There is evidence that this helps. There's growing body of evidence that twitations and Twimpact, as we call it, you know, the use of Twitter to get citations and the impact of Twitter is growing. Don't worry about all the stats. That's just boring. Here's another paper from the Journal of Transplantation. Said the odds of an article being highly cited were odds ratio 2.58. That's a huge odds ratio. You know, more highly cited if it's in blogs and Twitter, and you know, very highly statistically significant. And we systematically measure this on the journal now using altmetrics, so we're becoming very interested. So any help you can give us with your papers to get them out there is very much appreciated. And you'll notice if you look at the Journal of Advanced Nursing website or any other, you know, journal of that ilk, you'll see a little symbol like that. You can click on it, it'll tell you what the altmetrics are, and it also tells you where they come from. Now, just in the last 5 minutes or so. I mean, I could maybe leave a couple of minutes for questions if you want. I also edit Nursing Open, as I said. It's a very different model. It's an open access, pay-to-publish journal. Be absolutely clear, you're not paying to get your paper through the review system or accepted. You're paying to get it published. And then it's open access. That means you can share it with anyone. Papers in the Journal of Advanced Nursing, you're not free to do that unless you pay to get the copyright for them. Here, the copyright automatically comes with a Creative Commons license, and you pay. It's not cheap. It'll cost you a couple of thousand quid, probably, on my job. I don't deal with the money at all, but it's not cheap to do this. But you're paying to do something to give people use of the article that they would only get through a university library otherwise. And of course, you know, the university libraries are paying for Journal of Advanced Nursing. They don't have to pay for a journal like this. So it's a slightly different model. However, this has spawned a whole load of open access publishers. In a very short space of time, this is from Beale's predatory publisher website, which has actually been taken off. I think he was legally challenged by people, but it was a fantastic resource. But look at the growth in the number of publishers in 5 years, and the growth in the number of journals, and it's actually beyond that now. When Beale's list went down, it was over 1,000 different journals. Now, the vast majority of these are not bona fide journals. So if you're going to publish open access, be very, very careful. Any of you involved in the Department of Health, National Institute for Health projects or Research Council projects, you will be obliged to publish open access. So, and people, the predatory publishers know that. So find bona fide journals. Watch out for hijacked websites as well. There are websites that look like a journal. You know, they look exactly like, say, the Journal of Advanced Nursing website, except when you get into it, you've actually got to pay to publish. If that happens, be very careful. If you're worried at all about a journal, check the DOAJ, the Directory of Open Access Journals, and good journals should be on there with a green tick. Nursing Open is there, for example. It shows that they meet certain standards. They've got an editorial board, they've been established for more than a year, they've got a review process, all these kind of things. And usually they're expensive. The author processing charge there is $1,650, so that's actually not quite as much as I said. It's gone up slightly now. So you can see they're not cheap. The predatory publishers will often do it for, you know, £50 or something like that. They work on volume, but they don't offer any kind of service for you. They sometimes don't publish a paper. If they do, it's just a joke. People will not take it seriously. They don't really edit your papers either. There's a famous case of a paper with an obscenity in the title. Shan't repeat it in polite company. And that obscenity is repeated right throughout the paper. It was sent as a test to some open access journals, and some of them actually published it without edit. It just went straight up. So I can't emphasise enough, because I know people get taken in. Right, well, I have got children and grandchildren who need to have Christmas presents, so if you're really interested, there is a book called Writing for Publication in Nursing and Healthcare, Getting It Right, edited by myself and a colleague from Elsevier, Karen Holland. We're just about due to do a new edition, but you can get it online, hard copy, or whatever. It's available. And it's multi-authored. It's written by various experts in different areas of writing for publication. So I just thought I'd show you that. And finally, my email address. I saw people, I see people taking photographs. You're welcome to take photographs, but you can email me for the slides if you want. If you want to check up my own publications, you can check me on Orchid, and you can follow me if you're really bored and nothing else to do. You can follow me on Twitter. I might follow you back, but don't follow me on Facebook, because I won't follow you back on that. It's just too inundated with things to do. But you might want to follow me on Twitter, and you'll find the Journal of Advanced Nursing website and our departmental faculty website through that. I've got a couple of minutes for questions if anybody wants it. If not, I'm happy to finish, but I'm really glad to have met you all. Thanks very much indeed.
This podcast was produced in association with youpublicationslimited.com.